Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Review sharply criticizes how USA Gymnastics handled sexual abuse complaints. Former federal prosecutor Deborah Daniels issued 70 recommendations for the organization to improve gymnast safety. By Will Graves for the Associated Press. USA Gymnastics needs a complete cultural change to better protect athletes from sexual abuse, according to an independent review of the embattled organization's practices. The report, released Tuesday by former federal prosecutor Deborah Daniels, recommends that all USA Gymnastics members be required to immediately report suspected sexual misconduct to legal authorities and the U.S. Center for Safe Sport. Daniels also suggested that the USA Gymnastics prohibit adults from being alone with minor gymnasts at all times and bar unrelated adults from sharing or being alone in a sleeping room with gymnasts. She also recommended preventing adult members from having out-of-program contact with gymnasts through email, text, or social media. USA Gymnastics ordered the review last fall following a series of civil lawsuits filed against the organization and a former team doctor by a pair of gymnasts who claimed the physician sexually abused them during their time on the U.S. national team. USA Gymnastics has denied wrongdoing. The organization stated it went to authorities quickly in the summer of 2015 after hearing claims of abuse against Dr. Larry Nassar, but later amended the timeline following a Wall Street Journal report, saying it conducted a 5-week internal review before going to the FBI. A delay is impermissible, Daniel said. A Michigan judge on Friday ordered Nassar to stand trial on charges of sexually assaulting 6 young gymnasts who said he molested them while they were seeking treatment for various injuries. It is one of 4 criminal cases against Nassar in the state. Daniel said USA Gymnastics inadvertently suppressed reporting of abuse because of several factors, including that athletes are taught to follow instructions and obey coaches and trainers. Athletes sometimes aren't aware of where the boundaries are, so they're not trained in that regard, Daniel said. Parents aren't real sure either. Daniel said the organization needs to more closely monitor member clubs to make sure its bylaws are followed. She suggested stripping membership from clubs that fail to report claims of child abuse, plus periodic random audits to see if updated policies are being obeyed. USA Gymnastics has never felt it had the ability to exert influence over the club, Daniel said. You can use membership to enforce the policies. The USA Gymnastics Board of Directors unanimously voted to develop a plan to implement many of Daniel's 70 recommendations. We're confident it will make us a better organization to develop a culture that had safe sport as a top priority, said Chief Operating Officer Ron Gallimore. Daniel said the process USA Gymnastics had for investigating claims of abuse was cumbersome and somewhat mysterious. She suggested a more proactive approach. There needs to be a very clear protocol for how these reviews are conducted. There needs to be a clear timeline, she said. Frankly, they need to be kept in a database. We've recommended that the board have oversight of that entire process, while also taking the role of USA Gymnastics president out of the equation. Former President Steve Penney resigned in March under intensifying pressure for the way the organization handled charges of sexual abuse. Daniels wants USA Gymnastics to remove the president from determining the disposition of allegations. USA Gymnastics is in the process of finding Penney's replacement and hopes to have a successor in place by September. Whoever is hired will have plenty of work to do. Many of the recommendations fall in line with policies put forward by the U.S. Center for Safe Sport. The organization operates independently from the U.S. Olympic Committee and organizations governing Olympic sports. The USOC and the 47 national governing bodies, including USA Gymnastics, help fund the center, about $13.3 million over 5 years, but do not have any say over how it operates or the cases it investigates. Paul Perilla, chairman of the USA Gymnastics Board of Directors, said the organization needs to clearly articulate that the safety of the athletes is paramount. Gallimore said it is a priority to make sure everyone is aware and educated on everything from bullying to anything that would take away from having a safe environment. Daniel spoke to more than 160 people at all levels of USA Gymnastics over 6 months, attended 5 competitions, and visited the national team's training center at the Caroli Ranch in Huntsville, Texas, to produce the 144-page report. She said the number of gymnasts abused nationwide over the years is far higher than what has been reported based on her experience as a federal prosecutor, but stressed, "My recommendations are forward-looking and not in relation to anything that may have happened in the past." She also believes third parties should be allowed to report suspected abuse. The previous method of looking into alleged wrongdoing, a grievance process which required a written complaint from the aggrieved party or the parents of the aggrieved party if the athlete was a minor, was not well suited for reporting abuse, the report said. Young athletes in their teens or younger and their parents are highly unlikely to report ongoing abuse to the authority that has so much power over the athlete's success in the sport, Daniels wrote. AP sports writer Eddie Pels contributed to this report. Three Things to Know as Trump's Revised Travel Ban Takes Effect by Eric Jenkins. The Supreme Court on Monday announced it would allow parts of President Donald Trump's proposed travel ban to go into effect until it hears arguments from both sides in October. The move will reinstate many restrictions on travelers seeking to enter the United States from 6 Muslim-majority countries: Syria, Iran, Libya, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia. However, the court left open room for case-by-case exceptions, potentially setting up a confusing and contentious situation for travelers. Here are three things to know about the president's travel ban as it's set to be partially reinstated on June 29th. 1. It's unclear who will have bona fide ties to the U.S. In its unsigned opinion, the Supreme Court said it would uphold the travel ban's restrictions with the exception of those who have a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. Certain people qualify for such claims, such as a family member of someone living in the country, a student who has been accepted to an American university, or a worker who has been offered employment by an American company. But beyond that, the definition of a bona fide relationship becomes murky. What about a close friend seeking to visit from one of the affected countries? Or, as Temple University clinical law professor Jennifer Lee points out, refugees. They have no ties to the U.S., no jobs lined up, or familial connections, but are fleeing persecution and now are subject to this problematic definition of bona fide, Lee said. Indeed, Justice Clarence Thomas, who was joined in part by Justice Samuel Alito and Justice Neil Gorsuch, wrote in a partial dissent that the court's compromise was unworkable. The compromise also will invite a flood of litigation until this case is finally resolved on the merits, as parties and courts struggle to determine what exactly constitutes a bona fide relationship, who precisely has a credible claim to that relationship, and whether the claimed relationship was formed simply to avoid Trump's executive order, Thomas wrote. Lee said that refugees may still be able to gain entry under a waiver detailed in the executive order that allows government officials to admit foreign nationals on a case-by-case basis, even though most of the approvable circumstances involve people with those same bona fide relationships. It's unclear what the Trump administration will do, but the waivers could still come into play, said Adam Lauridsen, a partner at the firm Kecker Van Nest and Peters, working alongside the ACLU. There could be refugees who don't have family members in the U.S. who are admitted because they are in life-threatening situations. 2. The travel ban ruling is unlikely to cause chaos at airports. After Trump signed the executive order enacting the first version of his proposed travel ban in late January, some inbound travelers found themselves stuck in legal limbo at airports. Two Iraqi refugees, for example, were held up at New York City's John F. Kennedy International Airport, leading thousands of activists to gather in protest on the airport grounds. This time should be different, according to Bruce McIndoe, president of travel risk management and security company iJet International. This is not going to be a chaotic mess like we saw earlier this year, he said. This version is limited, and the administration is going to be a little more savvy about its implementation. McIndoe said that he still expects protesters to organize at relevant locations like airports, but that airlines are more prepared this time around. At the same time, some airport and Homeland Security officials around the country were confused as to how to carry out the ban's strict measures. Some were unsure if green card holders were included in the ban, for instance. Airlines are actually happier that this version of the travel ban is not being thrust on them with no pre-planning. It was very difficult in January, but this time around it's going to be more of a processing issue that takes place before travelers even land, McIndoe said. Once people have the appropriate documentation, the airlines are good to go. 3. The Supreme Court's timing could make the entire case moot. In its decision, the Supreme Court said that the 90-day ban on travelers from the 6 countries would begin June 29th. Additionally, a 120-day ban against nearly all refugees, regardless of origin, will go into effect on the same date. But the court won't hear the case until October, beyond the end of either window. That means the case may be moot by the time of oral arguments. Both bans are done on a calendar basis and will eventually have to reset, an attorney affiliated with the ACLU said. They may be expired by the time the case enters the Supreme Court, setting up a situation where the arguments being presented are moot. If a matter is moot in the court of law, it has no practical value and is generally viewed as purely academic or theoretical. Therefore, the court may not issue an official judgment on the travel ban or perhaps decide to not hear the arguments at all, according to the attorney. The court has not yet set a firm date for oral arguments in the case, but as the next term draws closer, all eyes will be watching the justices' plans closely. This is why the number of ultra-rich Americans is surging. There were 73,110 ultra-high-net-worth, UHNW, individuals in America in 2016, an increase of 6.7% from the year before, according to new data from the wealth information firm WealthX. The total is roughly the equivalent to the seating capacity of New Orleans Superdome. Another way to look at it is that one in every 4,500 Americans now has an ultra-high net worth, defined as $30 million or more. The surge was driven in large part by a strengthening U.S. dollar, which in turn drove equities, WealthX says. The U.S. dollar was a major factor in the fluctuating regional fortunes of the global ultra-wealthy population in 2016. Having strengthened over recent years, the currency appreciated to a 13-year high in trade-weighted terms immediately after the U.S. presidential election in November, delivering an across-the-board boost to domestic financial markets, the report said. Meanwhile, thanks to depreciation of the British pound in the wake of the Brexit vote, the number of UHNW Britons fell more than 14% to 8,860. At the same time, France saw its UHNW population climb 2.7% to 8,630. Here's a full list of the top 30. Number 1, the United States. Number 2, Japan. Number 3, China. Number 4, Germany. Number 5, the United Kingdom. Number 6, France. Number 7, Canada. Number 8, Hong Kong. Number 9, Switzerland. Number 10, Italy. At number 11, India. Number 12, South Korea. Number 13, Russia. Number 14, Brazil. Number 15, Spain. Number 16, Taiwan. Number 17, the Netherlands. Number 18, Sweden. Number 19, Saudi Arabia. Number 20, Australia. Number 21, Singapore. Number 22, Indonesia.
Number 23, Denmark. Number 24, Ireland. Number 25, Belgium. Number 26, Thailand. Number 27, Turkey. Number 28, the United Arab Emirates. Number 29, Mexico. And number 30, Iran. Globally, the worldwide UHNW population grew 3.5% in 2016, reaching a total of 226,450 individuals. Their combined wealth increased 1.5% to a whopping $27 trillion after a sharp decline in 2015, WealthX reports. However, the average net worth of UHNW individuals fell for the first time since 2013. The average person on WealthX's UHNW list is now worth only $120 million, down from $141 million. America's pets are getting much fatter, new research finds, by Melissa Chan. America's pets are growing increasingly fatter, new research has found. About one-third of dogs and cats in the U.S. are now overweight, according to a report released Tuesday by Banfield Pet Hospital, which operates nearly 1,000 veterinary clinics across the country and Puerto Rico. The organization found the number of overweight cats spiked 169% from 10 years ago, while the number of overweight dogs jumped 158%. Banfield said it analyzed visits in 2016 from 2.5 million dogs and 505,000 cats. The figures are alarming since obesity can have serious consequences and is associated with other chronic conditions and diseases, including arthritis and tracheal collapse in dogs, researchers said. Overweight pets and the many related conditions associated with those extra pounds are critical issues that we strive to both educate pet owners on and address in partnership with our clients to ultimately help pets live their best life, said Dr. Daniel Asia, Banfield's Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer, in a statement. The report said overfeeding and lack of exercise are major contributing factors of obesity in pets. Obesity plagues more than one-third of American adults, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Obesity is so common that many people underestimate their pet's body condition, preventing them from taking action to manage their pet's weight, the Banfield report said. Trump's chemical weapons warning raises the stakes for war in Syria, by Jared Malzin. The White House warning to Syrian President Bashar Assad on Monday that he would pay a heavy price for a new chemical attack lays out a test of President Donald Trump's own still-developing policy on the crisis in Syria, where as many as 500,000 people have died since 2011. Since April, Trump's administration has dramatically shifted the U.S. approach to the Assad regime, taking a confrontational stance that threatens to remake the contours of Syria's six-year-old civil war. The White House's threat of further hostilities, citing potential evidence of preparations of a new chemical attack, raises the possibility of a widening conflict with the Syrian regime or its Russian and Iranian allies. What the U.S. is intending to do with this statement is remind the Assad regime of the new posture of the United States under President Trump, said Lina Khatib, the head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House in London. It's more about U.S. posturing than a change in U.S. policy toward Syria, she added in a phone interview with Time. On April 6th, Trump ordered a cruise missile strike on a Syrian military airbase in response to a sarin attack that killed more than 70 people, including civilians, in Syria's Idlib province. The strike ended 6 years in which the U.S. avoided direct conflict with Assad, even while it supported elements of the armed insurrection against him in the aftermath of the popular uprisings that consumed Arab states in 2011. Since the missile strike, U.S. forces have struck pro-Assad forces 4 times, culminating a week ago when an American fighter jet shot down a Syrian bomber after it attacked American-allied militias on the ground in eastern Syria. It was the first time the U.S. military shot down a foreign jet in more than a decade, marking a sharp escalation in hostilities with Assad. The strike infuriated Russia, whose military threatened to track American aircraft as targets in the skies over the western part of Syria. With its statement Monday, Trump appeared to raise the stakes of the standoff, setting up a test of the deterrent capability of its strikes on Assad's forces. Limited punitive strikes and strong public statements are not enough to deter a regime that has killed hundreds of thousands of its own people, and they remain insufficient to ward off Russia and Iran, which have more to gain and lose in Syria than the United States, writes Charles Lister, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington on Tuesday. Trump's administration has also deepened U.S. involvement in the land war in Syria, where American troops are supporting a Kurdish-majority militia force battling the Islamic State. The militias, known as the Syrian Democratic Forces, are now advancing into the city of Raqqa, ISIS's de facto capital. As a result, the U.S. is now vying with rival powers, including the Assad regime, for control of land in eastern Syria seized from ISIS. Pro-Assad troops reached the Syrian-Iraqi border earlier in June, blocking the advances of another American-backed proxy force on the ground. Analysts said that the White House statement could be intended to send a message to Assad, Russia, and Iran about U.S. intentions in the strategic context in Syria's east. But the statement caught officials at the Pentagon and the State Department by surprise, according to several news reports. The statement made no reference to the sources of any intelligence it may have been based on. Nearly a day after the White House's declaration, there was no response from the Assad government. In Moscow, the head of the International Affairs Committee in the upper house of Russia's parliament, Konstantin Kosachev, called the White House's statement frightening. According to Russia's TASS news agency, he said, America could also be preparing its own preemptive strike against Syrian troops. The Assad regime's use of chemical weapons produced agony for Syrian civilians since the early days of the conflict. Former President Barack Obama first warned Assad in 2012 that the use of such arms would represent a red line that would change the American strategic calculus with regard to Syria. In August 2013, a chemical attack blamed on the regime killed more than 1,000 people in eastern Ghouta, a district on the outskirts of Damascus. The Obama administration threatened to strike Assad's forces, then backed down after the U.S. and Russia brokered a deal to remove the regime's chemical stockpile. The 2013 agreement removed nearly 1,300 tons of chemicals from Syria, but failed to eliminate Assad's entire stockpile. Chemical attacks continued as a part of the regime's assault on sections of the country controlled by rebel groups. According to the Syrian American Medical Society, a leading humanitarian aid group, the government carried out at least 161 chemical attacks from the start of the conflict through 2015. Those attacks appear to be part of a strategy to demoralize the civilian population of areas controlled by the armed opposition. In many of those attacks, government troops used chlorine, an industrial chemical first used as a weapon by the German military in the First World War. The use of chlorine, as opposed to sarin, creates another complication for the Trump administration's evolving policy. A chlorine attack reported in northern Syria a day after the cruise missile strikes resulted in no military action. Syrian opposition activists have long called on the United States to impose a no-fly zone over rebel-held areas of Syria in order to stop indiscriminate attacks on civilians. Airstrikes by Assad's forces and its Russian supporters have devastated entire cities, including Aleppo, where rebels and civilians were forced to flee in December 2016. Supporters of the Syrian opposition were skeptical in response to the White House's announcement. I would understand the message in another way. You can use all weapons to take lands, but not chemical, said Abdul Kafi Alhamdo, an English teacher from Aleppo who was displaced from the city in December in a WhatsApp message to journalists. In a sign of the continuing toll of the American-led air war against ISIS, Syrian activists reported on Tuesday that a coalition airstrike on an Islamic State prison in eastern Syria killed nearly 60 people. Reports of civilian casualties in the U.S.-led air campaign have surged in recent months, killing more than 1,000 people in March alone, according to the London-based monitoring group Air Wars. Forget words. A lot of millennials say GIFs and emojis communicate their thoughts better than English. By Katie Steinmetz. Visuals like emojis and GIFs can make up for the useful cues that are often missing from digital chit-chatting. The raise of an eyebrow, the shrug of the shoulders, the rolling of an eye. But a new survey reveals that many people believe those visuals aren't just helpful for adding clarity in text and mobile messages. They actually feel that they can better express themselves through these digital tools than through old-fashioned English. In a survey conducted by Harris Poll and commissioned by GIF platform Tenor, 36% of millennials ages 18 to 34 who use visual expressions such as emojis, GIFs, and stickers say that those images better communicate their thoughts and feelings than words do. That's more than twice the amount of people over the age of 65 who say the same. Roughly a quarter of people in the age groups between those two demographics feel that images can paint a clearer picture than words. When asked solely about conveying emotion through animated images, the preference was even greater. Nearly two-thirds of millennials said GIFs did the job better than words, compared to about 40% of those in their golden years. People fundamentally crave the ability to express the full range of human emotions, said Tenor CEO David McIntosh. And unlike emojis, a static and limited set of images, GIFs can intersect with moments of pop culture that convey a far broader range of sentiments and inside jokes. The poll, released Tuesday, surveyed more than 2,000 U.S. adults in May. Of the sample, about 1,400 said they use such visuals in text or mobile messaging. And when asked the question with slightly different wording, whether those images help people better understand the thoughts and feelings I'm trying to communicate than words alone, almost 80% agreed. While the majority of people across age groups also said they feel more connected to people they frequently message when using emojis and GIFs, young people expressed a much higher level of comfort with smiley faces than actual dialogue. When asked whether they're more comfortable expressing emotions through those visuals than through phone conversations, 68% of millennials agreed, compared to 37% of those over the age of 65. McIntosh said the company frequently surveys its users and keeps track of what people are searching for when they go looking for a GIF. The company has counted up billions of unique searches for smile or smirk or SMH that users often make a lot more specific by combining with a person or movie or moment. After all, a Steph Curry smile is a lot different than a grin from a Cheshire Cat or a Beamer from Harry Potter. The term GIF is 30 years old this year, but as technology has improved and the amount of digital video has exploded, those graphic files have become a language of their own. As McIntosh put it, what might seem like goofy nonsense does useful work in helping people more accurately express the thoughts and feelings and emotions trapped in their head. They're also just a good time. More than half of people of all ages said they use emojis and GIFs in messages to make people laugh, to lighten the mood, and because they make conversations more fun. Can Mitch McConnell save the Republican health care bill? By Alex Altman. One of Washington's unwritten rules is this simple maxim: never underestimate Mitch McConnell. Yet even the Senate Republican leader, regarded by both parties as one of Capitol Hill's craftiest tacticians, proved unable to steer a wildly unpopular health care bill through the Senate this week on his own crushing timetable. Facing resistance from moderates and conservatives in the GOP conference, not to mention an outcry from powerful outside groups ranging from medical associations to the Koch brothers, McConnell announced that he would delay the vote until after the July 4th recess. Legislation of this complexity almost always takes longer than anyone else would hope, the Kentuckian told reporters in the Capitol on Tuesday afternoon. We're still working toward getting at least 50 people in a comfortable place. McConnell's daunting challenge was compounded on Monday by a report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. It estimated the Senate's bill, while saving the federal government some $321 billion over the next decade, would also swell the ranks of the uninsured by 22 million people and result in about 15 million losing Medicaid coverage. Even as McConnell vowed to hold a final vote before the Senate skipped town this week, allies urged him to take his foot off the gas. Plowing ahead in the face of colleagues' opposition would be a mistake, said Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, one of several Republican senators to criticize the bill. If Leader McConnell says failure is not an option, don't set yourself up for failure. With 52 Republicans in the Senate and no Democratic support, McConnell had room for only two defections. Under budgeting rules, the bill requires 50 votes for passage, with Vice President Mike Pence breaking the tie. At least five Republicans signaled they would oppose a motion to bring the bill to the floor. It's a terrible bill, Republican Senator Rand Paul, McConnell's Kentucky colleague, told reporters on Monday night. It's worse to pass a bad bill than pass no bill. Despite the setback, Republicans and Democrats alike say it would be foolish to count McConnell out. The Senate bill, drafted in private by a small group of Republicans, is an opening bid, not a finished product. Now the process moves to the bartering stage. And McConnell has some $188 billion, the amount of additional cash the Senate can spend before running afoul of budgeting rules with which to sweeten the deal. Already, the bill was being written with an eye toward winning the votes of recalcitrant Republicans. For example, one way the draft legislation would slash Medicaid spending is by transferring funds from states that spend lots of money per Medicaid enrollee to more parsimonious states. But it carves out a special exception for sparsely populated states, including Alaska, whose Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has expressed reservations about the plan. More side deals may now be in the offing. Moderate Republicans who represent swaths of Appalachia, like West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito and Ohio's Rob Portman, are seeking more federal dollars to help combat the opioid crisis ravaging their states. The pair had sought some $45 billion for the project over the next decade. So far, the Senate bill allots $2 billion. The bill's conservative critics have different concerns. Small government Republicans like Utah's Mike Lee and Ted Cruz of Texas, who have said they aren't ready to support the bill, might be swayed by free market initiatives like health savings accounts. There are a host of tools we can use, Cruz said Monday, that would have a significant impact on premiums. All this horse trading is a familiar, if unsavory, component of threading major legislation through Congress. To attract the necessary votes to pass Obamacare, Democrats tucked in state-specific giveaways to senators and made costly concessions to the insurance and pharmaceutical lobbies. Those moves drew Republican ire. Some GOP senators who are prepared to swallow McConnell's bill warn they might bolt if a similar process unfolds now. Getting the Affordable Care Act passed and signed took Obama and his allies 15 months, as McConnell alluded to in his press conference Tuesday. The GOP leader is trying to repeat the feat in a relative eye blink. We've got a lot of discussions going on, McConnell insisted, and we're still optimistic we're going to get there. He has defied precedent before. It was McConnell who orchestrated his party's blanket obstruction to Barack Obama's agenda. McConnell who devised the plan to deny a vote to Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland. And McConnell who steered the GOP back to the majority despite its dismal brand. As his allies laud and opponents lament, he is as effective as he is ruthless. So if the forces of Washington seem arrayed against him, not to mention the sheer complexity of a bill that would upend 1/6 of the U.S. economy, Republicans are taking solace from that ironclad Washington adage. I would not bet against Mitch McConnell, House Speaker Paul Ryan insisted Tuesday. He will find out soon if his colleagues still agree. With reporting by Philip Elliott and Emma Tolkoff in Washington. Everything to Know About Today's Worldwide Ransomware Attack by Robert Hackett. Meet the sequel to WannaCry, the wide-ranging ransomware attack that crippled businesses around the globe last month. On Tuesday, another widespread ransomware attack began halting unprepared businesses in their tracks. The new attack uses the same method of propagation as WannaCry, a leaked hacking tool called Eternal Blue, which has been linked to the U.S. National Security Agency. One of the major differences between the two attacks is that the most recent event does not yet appear to be susceptible to a hard-coded kill switch. That means it may prove harder to overcome. Security experts have been warning organizations that fail to apply security patches to their Microsoft Windows-based computer systems that it was only a matter of time before another digital siege surfaced. It seems their predictions have borne true. Here's a quick FAQ to get you up to speed. What has happened? A wave of ransomware attacks spread like wildfire on Tuesday. Many Microsoft Windows-based computers, specifically ones not protected against a vulnerability in a Microsoft messaging protocol called SMB-1, began seizing up worldwide, locking employees out of their desktops and displaying ransom notes. Unable to access their files and folders, workers and managers were greeted by on-screen demands for payment of $300 in Bitcoin, a digital currency often used by cyber extortionists because it's easy to send and hard to track. Who's been affected? The attack struck organizations in the U.S., Italy, Germany, Poland, Ukraine, and Russia. Kostin Ryu, director of global research at Russian security firm Kaspersky Labs, posted a bar graph on Twitter showing the geographic distribution of victims, according to what his firm could measure. Kaspersky's customer base skews towards Russian-speaking countries, which might explain the spread. Some of the affected companies include Maersk, the Danish shipping giant, Rosneft, the Russian oil company, WPP, the British advertising agency, and Merck, the U.S. pharmaceutical giant. There are reports that the attack has also affected banks, hospitals, governments, airports, and other organizations. What is PETCHA? Initial analyses suggested that the latest wave of attacks involve malware based on PETCHA, a type of ransomware that first surfaced last year. Further investigations have disputed this analysis. In lieu of a better name, some cybersecurity firms, such as Kaspersky, have begun referring to the latest malware as not PETCHA. Jeremiah Grossman, chief security strategist at the cybersecurity firm Sentinel One, told Fortune there isn't enough evidence yet to uncover the malware's provenance. This outbreak has similar characteristics as PETCHA, such as infecting the MBR, which is the master boot record, an important component of Microsoft computer hard drives, and encrypting the entire drive. However, it is not clear yet that this is a PETCHA variant, he said. How did this happen? Companies that failed to patch their systems against the Microsoft vulnerability were open to this attack. It's still not clear what the initial attack vector was, but once inside, the worm could spread across computer networks via the hole in Microsoft SMB1. It seems that many of the organizations affected by the malware operated industrial systems. These machines can be hard to patch because they run critical processes and are difficult to take offline. Organizations like these typically have a hard time patching all of their machines because so many systems simply cannot have downtime, said Chris Wasopel, co-founder and chief tech officer of Veracode, an application security firm purchased by CA Technologies earlier this year. What can businesses do to protect themselves? There are a few simple steps businesses can take, as the cybersecurity firm Palo Alto Networks explains on its Threat Brief blog. First, apply Microsoft Patch MS-17-010. Second, block connections to Microsoft Windows port 445, the part of the operating system associated with the vulnerable protocol. And finally, maintain regular data backups and use them to restore systems. Should you pay the ransom? This is a continual source of debate in the information security community. The general belief is no, you should not pay the ransom. For one, there's no guarantee extortionists will return your files. Second, funding cyber criminals will encourage them to develop similar attacks in the future. Still, sometimes companies take a gamble and pay up in the hopes that the criminals will restore access to their files and information. In this case, it appears as though customers will not be able to reclaim their data even if they do pay up. Postio, the email service chosen by the attackers, said it blocked the account they created, meaning the extortionists have lost their channel to communicate with victims and hand over decryption keys. Despite this, the attacker's Bitcoin wallet had already received 28 transactions equaling 3 Bitcoins, or more than $7,000, as of 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.